Well, that makes me feel good already. Being involved in loving relationships, whether they're part of your immediate family or an extended family, as my cousin Elise, or all of you who really are part of my extended family. We have many connections, all of us. So, your health, what does love have to do with it? My health. What does love have to do with my health? Well, for most of us, this title brings up some memories of lyrics in our past, doesn't it? Tina Turner's immortal lyrics. As she ends the song, she's saying, "I've been taking on a new direction. And I have to say, I've been thinking about my own protection. It scares me to feel this way. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when?" Can you finish that? "When a heart can be broken." Wow. So for many individuals, love, at least on an instinctive level, has become synonymous with a four-letter word. It's a figment of the imagination. It's a fleeting emotion that is so tied to pain and suffering in our lives. So, what does love have to do with our health? What does the research have to say about love in our physical health as well as emotional health? Is love just kind of a bonus, right? It's just kind of it's for those amongst us who are kind of lucky, who get to have love. But it can't be as important as all those other things that impact our health, that impact our heart health, our brain health, our liver health, our immune system. It can't be as important as what we eat. It can't be as important as having daily exercise. It can't be as important as avoiding smoking and avoiding alcohol and avoiding overeating and avoiding an activity, can it? I mean, we daily get information from the media about the power of exercise to overcome, the power of avoiding things that are bad for us and how that influences our physical and emotional health. But can we avoid our way into good health? Can we simply, by avoiding overeating, avoiding alcohol, avoiding tobacco, avoiding inactivity, can we, by avoiding those kind of those four big things that there's so much research about, will that in of itself give us good health? Well, let's kind of review some of the studies on this. In the last few years, various researchers and scientists have actually won the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology by uncovering the secrets of the chromosomes in our body. And there is a special part of the chromosomes, the proteins that hold our genetic information in them. There's a special part of that that actually is the cap. It's what we could call the cornerstone of our chromosomes. And this cap or cornerstone is called telomeres. Have you heard of it? Has any of you heard about the telomere? Several of you have. And what's interesting is that researchers just in the last few years have been uncovering the secrets that when the cell divides, this cornerstone, this capstone of our chromosomes that hold them together, they actually start shortening. Every single time the cell divides, this cap of our genetic information gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And it's been referred to as as the clock that relates to aging, as the telomere shortens, we age. And we're not talking just chronological age here, because really chronological age isn't the problem. The problem is the lack of healing that occurs. The aging process itself in the cells, as the cells become less capable of rejuvenation. The cells, the tissues, the organs become less effective in this self-healing modality that was created into them. And the telomeres are now, we're able to look at those and see what is happening in this biological aging process. Research just published a few months ago found that regular participation in strenuous physical activity, you know, the type of activity that's not just walking the dog and you take a few steps and watch the dog sniff, 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 and take a few more steps, right? And sniff, sniff, sniff. We're talking about strenuous physical activity. The heartbeat is racing. The lungs are laboring. We're perspiring. We end up feeling, wow, that was a good effort I put in. Strenuous physical activity has been shown to actually dramatically alter this tick, 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 tick of the telomeres. This, what we had thought was just an inevitable ticking away, where the telomere is losing its structure, losing its length, that is now being resolved by things like daily exercise. And what the researchers found was is that this daily exercise was actually increasing the production of an enzyme known as telomerase. This is a specific enzyme that helps repair that cornerstone of our chromosomes, of our genetic information. And so it maintains the length. And so this is an important understanding for us, is that when we participate in daily exercise, where our heart rate goes up and our lungs are expanding and our muscles are working hard, that actually enhances the God-given, the God-created, the God-inspired portion of the body that allows itself to heal naturally. So exercise is clearly very important. Other research just published in December of 2010 found that individuals who smoked had a dramatic reduction in the size and length of the telomeres. You see, because certain toxins in environment, of course, cigarette smoke has thousands of toxins in it, they interfere with the body's natural God-given ability to heal itself. And so, consequently, the telomere is unable to be rebuilt, and that constitutes biologic aging. So biologic aging involves an impairment in the natural ability of the body to heal itself. The use and abuse of alcohol unquestionably increases cancer risk. There's been a lot of debate. There's been a lot of talk about the value of alcohol when used in moderation for cardiovascular disease. That's recently been shown that even the moderate consumption of alcohol actually does not increase your health. That was a methodological problem with the earlier studies. Okay, but regardless of how we feel about that, because you can find all kinds of research to try to support whatever position we're most comfortable with, regardless of how we feel about the potential value of alcohol and its impact on cardiovascular health, there is no question in the medical literature, no question whatsoever, that even moderate amounts of alcohol increase the risk of cancer risk. No question. It kind of flies under the radar. So this, and certainly as moderate drinking gets into more heavy drinking, that constitutes a much greater risk for cancer. Increased premature disability, an increase in premature death. And then we have this fourth item that we've been talking, that so many of us try to avoid, and that's the question of overeating. Some of you may recognize the writing of Shakespeare in King Henry IV, the playwright. He said, "Leave gormandizing, know thy grave doth gape for thee thrice wider than for other men." Now, I have to admit that the first time I read that, I had to read it again, and I had to read it again, and then I was able to deduce and break it down into plain English. Essentially, Shakespeare was an extremely wise and intuitive individual that by observing human nature, by observing human and social phenomena, he understood the risk associated with different factors. This was well before the age of epidemiology, where scientists were able to quantify and study populations and establish that individuals who were prone to overeating actually were three times more likely to die prematurely. Hence, Shakespeare's earlier understanding stating that those individuals who eat regularly of rich foods, gormandizers, are three times more likely to fall into their grave prematurely. Leave gormandizing. Know thy grave doth gape for thee thrice wider than for other men. Part of the understanding of this comes from a relatively new understanding of hepatitis. Most of us believe that the majority of hepatitis comes from drinking alcohol in excess. And there's certainly a problem with that world over. However, a far more likely cause of hepatitis is overeating. There is far more liver disease and liver failure today in our world from overeating than there is from alcohol. It's little known in our society, but very, very true. So now we have these four behaviors that we're talking about. The inactivity, which is rampant and dominant in our society. 80% of us are essentially couch potatoes. We're inactive. And it's a real struggle for us, however well-intended we might be, to get off the couch, right, and put down that clicker, that remote control, and get outside, right? What's the hardest thing about exercise? Yeah, it's basically getting off the couch or getting out of bed and putting on our walking or running shoes and getting out the door. That's the hardest thing about exercise. It's not doing the exercise. Exercise is pleasant most of the time. So that's a challenge. More than 80% of us struggle with that. We know that smoking is responsible for more than 50% of all strokes, and those strokes that occur in those under the age of 65. Did you know that? 50% of all strokes under the age of 65 caused specifically and exclusively because of tobacco products. But, see, that's as important as all those things are. Those pale in significance when contrasted with more important risk factors. It's been shown in research that a feeling of isolation, a feeling of rejection, emotional rejection in our hearts, and this is a perception. If we just simply feel the perception of isolation or rejection, we are at least 2 to 5 times more likely to risk premature death from all causes than those amongst us who perceive that we are loved, who perceive that we're accepted, and don't have the sense of isolation or rejection. All right, now, studies here in California, Alameda County study and others have shown this. I'm going to read this, that this risk factor, the feeling of isolation or rejection, the lack of acceptance, the lack of experiencing love and forgiveness in our lives personally, is a more powerful predictor of health and long life than smoking, use of alcohol, inactivity, and overeating, or all other practices combined. Did you catch that? The first time I read over that, I didn't catch that. Okay? I could not conceive that the lack of any exercise, the lack of a healthy diet, in fact, just the presence of a really unhealthy diet, the immoderate and abuse of alcohol and tobacco, all of them together don't come close to the impact, the negative impact on our personal physical health, not just emotional health, but physical health when contrasted to the lack of love and acceptance in our lives. Well, that if we come to accept that, and I'd be happy to share the medical studies that show that to be true. Once we come to accept that, it changes, it should change what our focus should be. Dr. Dean Ornish tells the story of a man who joined his reversing heart disease study over 20 years ago. He was actually a very fit man, and as he introduced himself to the group of other individuals seeking to reverse their heart disease, he talked about how he'd been an Olympic athlete. He talked about how he exercised so many hours a day. And he looked fit. He happened to be, I think, the only individual in the entire study that died prematurely during the study. And he appeared to be the fittest one in the whole group. It was later, after Dr. Ornish talked with this gentleman's relatives, that he found out that he had never been to the Olympics. He was not an elite athlete, certainly not the person that he said he had been. But for some reason, he did not feel the love and acceptance, and so he had to make up a life that really wasn't him at all. He lied about who he was because he wasn't comfortable with the person that he actually was. And he was always competing with himself and with others. And so, suggesting that a healthy, a great fitness program in of itself isn't going to be enough. It isn't going to be adequate to make us healthy. I had the privilege while working in Guam as a medical missionary to conduct a six-month program. It was a lifestyle intervention program that lasted for 6 months. So we had a group of individuals that we saw daily for 2 weeks and then twice a week for several months and at least weekly for the remaining 3 months of the six-month program. So we got to know them really well. We became fast friends. And during the first 6 weeks or so of the program, we had more than enough to do dealing with all these physical risk factors, cholesterol and blood sugars and cardiac CRP, the measures of inflammation, blood pressure and weight, and all the things that go into a comprehensive medical program to deal with people who have serious health risks, serious health concerns. And so during the first 2 weeks of the program, we see tremendous progress in reversing diabetes and heart disease and kidney failure. And the patients are just amazed at how quickly the body can recover, how quickly the body can heal itself if it's just given an opportunity. If it's just given enough of the tools available in nature to allow that healing mechanism that was created within us to begin to work. You can't have this assembly line of healing working unless all the pieces are available for that assembly line to construct these mechanisms of healing in the body. And so once we have this expanded synergy taking place, we see dramatic rates of healing. But after the first 6 weeks, after they've recognized the power and they've seen, they haven't just heard about the research, they've seen the changes within their own bodies, that's when we start bringing in some of these other risk factors. And there's a questionnaire that I would provide my patients called Am I at Risk? It's actually a questionnaire that had been validated 50 years ago at the University of North Carolina. And various doctors had put this together that demonstrated the power of our emotions on our physical health. And they actually gave this test called the hostility profile, part of the emotional evaluation, to 25-year-old physicians and lawyers at the University of North Carolina. There they quantified which group of individuals fell in the upper half of hostility. In other words, they had higher scores as it related to a tendency to aggressiveness, okay, which is the behavior of hostility. You might see that on the highway where somebody cuts somebody off. That's an aggressive behavior. You might see that when somebody lays on the horn or shakes a fist at somebody or in another setting might push somebody or might advance on somebody. That's an aggressive, hostile behavior. Most of us, however, who have a tendency to hostility are pretty good at holding back aggressiveness. Anger, on the other hand, which is the emotion of hostility, is not so easy for most of us to fully control. It kind of builds up within us, and we're maybe other people can't notice it as easily. They might see some of the side effects, okay? Rapid breathing, kind of, you know, a little bit redder cheeks or redder or kind of aggressive or angry looking. But the one thing that is hard to escape for us is the attitude of hostility, which is kind of it's a perception of cynicism. When I first took this test over 25 years ago, I thought it was a peacemaker. I thought I had my two best friends in high school were arch enemies, and I was always trying to bring them together and come on, let's get along. And so I always looked at myself as the peacemaker. When I took this test, this test that looked at, am I at risk, physically at risk because of my emotions, I came away from that with a whole new understanding of my risk. I came away understanding that it doesn't require an aggressive personality or even an angry personality to affect my emotional and physical health. Just an attitude of cynicism, of distrust, can affect that. And I could tell you a lot about that, but there's not enough time to tell you about that right now. So I learned a lot about that. But during this program, I remember as I waited about 15 minutes for all the participants in this specific program about 10 years ago to finish this 50-question questionnaire. And it's a self-grading questionnaire. You don't even have to turn it in. But I was watching their faces. And these individuals that had been so effective at lowering their cholesterol and their blood sugars and their weight and their blood pressure, and they were feeling so much better, now came up against a whole new risk factor, a whole new layer, right? When we talk about improving our health, it's like peeling an onion, right? It's, we get rid of the first couple layers, and we think we're really doing pretty good, and then we realize, oh, there's another layer there that we got to work on. It's just kind of like gardening. You can get the bigger rocks out, but after a while, the other rocks tend to come up. And that's life. That's part of humanity is recognizing that there's always going to be risks lurking around. And if we're willing and open to discover what those risks might be, we can actually alter and change that risk and remove it from the equation so it's not damaging our ability to heal and rejuvenate. There was one lady in particular that I was watching, and she had been so elated that she'd finally come across a program that helped her with her risk of heart disease. Cholesterol had gone way down. She'd learned so much about nutrition, so much about other things. She'd started feeling so much better. And when she finished taking that test, I remember she just put that paper down, and she couldn't even look up. And after everybody left that evening, she stayed by and she came up to me and she told me a story. She says, I live on a block with two other ladies who are fairly close to me and houses nearby. She says, about 20 years ago, one of the neighbor ladies said something about my children that offended me so much that I have not spoken to her since. 20 years have gone by. She says, I would be walking down the street of my own neighborhood, down the sidewalk, and I'd see her coming the other way, and I'd cross the street so I wouldn't have to talk to her. We would avoid each other at all costs because there was so much negative emotion. And so I said to her, I said, what do you think you should do about that? She says, I don't know. It's been 20 years. I can't imagine bringing myself to the point of talking to her again. So I said, well, just think about it. Now, one of the benefits of addressing these other physical risk factors, like inactivity, okay, like nutrition, etc., is that as we begin to be effective in dealing with those, it actually does something to us. It changes our emotions as well. See, that's the beauty. Even though they're not nearly as important as the emotions are, it actually helps modify the emotions. So that's part of that synergy that we're talking about today. And so she, recognizing that by herself, she was not going to be strong enough to exercise every day. So she recruited one of her other neighbor ladies, says, I need your help. I can't do this by myself. Would you be my walking partner? And what's interesting about this is that these three ladies all belong to different churches. So it made for a very interesting dialogue. And so as she began her regular walking program with this other neighbor lady from another church, that night, she called up her friend and says, we're going to be walking tomorrow morning, right? She says, yeah, we always walk. So I just want to make sure because there's something I need to talk to you about. So this walking partner had become her confidant. So she begins to discuss the next morning the history, which her friend knew a lot about because it had been 20 years of this conflict going on. So that night in our session at the wellness center, she told me, I talked to my walking partner And I just don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I can talk to her about this. And so I had challenged the whole group. This is one of the measures of mental health is a willingness to deal with pain in our lives at all costs. See, A definition of mental illness is a tendency to avoid pain in our lives at all costs. I don't want to deal with that. Don't ask me to do that. That's going to cause pain. That's going to cause a lot of, well, bad memories to come up. See, the reality is those memories keep popping up all the time anyways because we haven't resolved them. Unless we've resolved that conflict, unless we've done our part in resolving that conflict, there is going to be long-lasting destruction and oxidant stress in our body, damaging our heart, damaging our nerves, damaging the brain, damaging every organ of our body. So I challenge them to make a decision in the next 24 hours of what they would do next. Pick up that phone. Do something. Yes, it's uncomfortable, but you won't believe how good you'll feel after you've had that conversation. Next night, she came to me and says, you know what happened this morning? She says, my walking partner showed up this morning with one of her friends. And guess who that friend was? It was my neighbor lady who I'd avoided for 20 years. And she said, we just stood there kind of looking at each other in the discomfort of that moment. And we looked at each other's eyes and we realized that both of us were tearing and our hearts melted and we embraced each other and we both apologized to each other for being foolish schoolgirls, for waiting so long to bring back a relationship that had been so powerful and so nurturing for so many years previously. And now they're back together. Friends, willing to ask for forgiveness and willing to give forgiveness. In that same group, there was a gentleman, a professor, at the local university, very, very bright man, who had been told by his internist that unless he got serious about his diabetes, he probably only had a year or two left, and that he could have a stroke at any time. He says, your kidneys are so damaged that you've already lost half of the function of your kidneys. You need to get serious about this. He says, I've never had a doctor talk to me that way. Praise God for doctors who are willing to tell you the way it is. Because how can we change unless we understand the risks that we're up against? Right? Most of us aren't willing to change unless we recognize what might happen unless we do. So during the program, he had within 1 month reversed the majority of that kidney failure. Reversed the majority of it. And he was so excited that he would go home and tell his aging mother who lived with him, says, Mother, this is wonderful. You need to take advantage of it. Because you see, she also had diabetes. But she would not listen to him. She would not have anything to do with that. And, you know, he was shocked by this. He couldn't understand why his mother, who was a very intelligent lady, would not even listen to and participate in something that he had gained so much from. And he would talk about this in the group. He was at a loss for why this was happening. About 3 to 4 months into the program, one night he said to us, you know, you know that my mother hasn't been all that excited about what I've been doing. And I couldn't understand it. Because I know she loves me, and I know that she cares for me, and I know that she's happy that I'm doing better, but for some reason, she doesn't want to have any part of it. So he says, last night we had an unusually a special evening together where we began talking about all the things that were really important. You know, we've had those conversations with people that we love from time to time. And so he thought this was the opportune time to broached the subject one more time, and he said, "Mom, why can't you embrace this newfound understanding of actually being able to reverse this diabetes?" And he said to us, "My mother turned to me and looked me straight in the eye, and she said, son, I don't deserve to have my diabetes reversed." And he said, what do you mean you don't deserve this? I don't understand, Mom. And she said, son, God is punishing me for the sins of my youth. Wow, the whole group was like, you know, what would you say if somebody close to you said that to you? And by little, by talking with her son about these issues, she learned that God wasn't punishing. God had no intention that she should suffer through this because of something that she had done. God wanted her to find healing, to experience healing. And what was the main thing that she was missing? The main thing was that she was missing an understanding that God had already forgiven her for those things. You see, we can't give what we don't have. If we can't fully accept forgiveness, if we can't fully accept love in our lives, then we can't give that unconditionally to other people around us, even to those that we really want to give it to. So it's a critical thing to understand. Studies have shown that the trait of anger is associated with a higher blood sugar, even in people without diabetes. See, because the trait of anger encourages the release of certain stress hormones from the adrenal glands that then go to the liver and tell the liver to dump sugar, because anger suggests that something needs to happen. We need to fight something or run away from something. And so one of the risks associated with blood sugar challenges has to do with our emotions. Other studies have shown that young men who have the trait of anger are 3 times more likely to suffer stroke. 3 times more likely to suffer stroke. And when the researchers interviewed these young men to discover what were the key factors that were contributing to this trait, this characteristic of anger, they discovered that a common denominator was the lack of love, the perception that their father had not loved them. So it's critical that in our lives we find ways to make it clear to our family members, to our neighbors, to our coworkers, that we indeed wish for their best interest, that we indeed love them. My favorite definition of love is a definition given by Dr. Scott Peck, who's a psychiatrist, passed away about 5 years ago. But some of you may recall the book, the best-selling book that he authored called The Road Less Traveled. And in that book, he defines love as the willingness to extend ourselves for the purpose of nourishing somebody's spiritual or emotional health. Okay, so love isn't this great feeling that we get when we're with somebody that makes us feel good. Now, that is an aspect of love, certainly. That's a great quality of love. But it is not the most important quality of love. Love is a willingness. It's a decision. It's a choice for us to extend ourselves, to go beyond our comfort zone, to go beyond what we'd normally do for somebody else and say, because I care for this person's best interest, I am going to do this for them. above and beyond my own comfort level. Studies have shown that individuals who have gone through spinal cord injuries, who by all accounts have many reasons to be angry at life, because now they've lost a key function of their body. But these individuals who are willing to take on a forgiving attitude towards life, not just towards one or two individuals, but towards life, they actually heal far more rapidly than individuals that are not willing or are not aware of that relationship. There's something powerful about emotions. There's something powerful, especially about love and forgiveness, that dramatically enhances the healing qualities that God has placed inside of our bodies, physically. Many of us were unwillingly exposed to the alleged tirades of Mel Gibson in 2010. Heard him on the radio, on TV. He was the talk of California and the nation. And we couldn't help but wonder what led such a successful person who had a loving wife and had a loving extended family, a large immediate family, successful beyond comparison with so many individuals, to get to that low. And of course, we know that a big part of that had to do with alcohol abuse, and all the other factors that go along with that type of compulsion. See, whenever we have a compulsion in our lives, whatever it might be, and by the way, most of us are susceptible to at least one compulsion. Something that can easily derail us from the direction that we know we should be going. That it easily derails us. We're susceptible to that, especially at times when we're at greater stress, especially at times when we're tired, when we're lonely, when we're hungry. We're susceptible to that compulsion, that addiction. For some of us, it's addictions that are very visible in our society. For others of us, it's compulsions and addictions that are very secretive and not visible to our society. But when somebody goes through these type of challenges, it's not the act itself. It's not the alcohol abuse or the gambling or whatever it might be that actually causes the most damage. It's the lack of attention to all the other healing factors that could be there to help bolster and bring healing to the body and to the brain and to the mind. But they're all being avoided. A key example of that was shown remarkably several years ago in the Department of Corrections study in England. What researchers at the Department of Correction wanted to discover is if there was any possible relationship between nutrients and violent behavior. And so they were looking at a large group of young violent offenders that had been imprisoned because of their violent behavior. And they developed a double-blind, placebo-controlled study that very, very clearly, it's the gold standard in medical research. It took the researchers out of the equation because they didn't know who was getting the treatment medications or nutrients. And the subjects themselves, the prisoners, didn't know who was getting these nutrients or this drug. You know what the drug was? It wasn't Prozac. It wasn't Xanax. It wasn't any of the popular drugs that deal with our emotions. It was actually cod liver oil and a vitamin mineral supplement. Now, when you first looked at the methods of that study, if I'd been asked to evaluate that, I'd go, whoa, you're going to have a lot of those to make a difference. And, maybe for people who are sort of normal, that might help them. But for young violent offenders, how could something as small as a little supplement of cod liver oil and a little supplement of vitamins and minerals going to make a big difference, especially in a small amount of time? Well, do you know that within 9 months of this double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial, when the researchers broke the code and established the actual impact of those nutrients on these young, violent men, they discovered that those who had been inadvertently, because it was a controlled trial, inadvertently been given the omega-3-rich supplement along with the vitamin mineral supplement, they were 40% less likely to have committed violent acts during that 9 month period compared to those who had not received that supplement. 40%. Now, as the researchers discussed this in the medical literature, they said, we would have never guessed it had that much impact. This has more influence on their behavior, their attitude, their emotions, and their behavior. Cynicism, anger, and aggressiveness had more impact in all those three aspects of hostility than all the anger management classes and all the other programs that the Department of Correction had been involved in. There is so much to what we eat and how we think and how we act. And if we just appreciated that a little bit more, we would be far more careful about what we actually take into our body. Because when we struggle with our emotions and when we struggle, why am I so mean to her? Why am I so indifferent about this person's plight? Why am I so quick to criticize this person for what they have done when I know that I have other things in my life that are far worse than theirs? Why? And so we sit back and ask ourselves why we act the way we do. And so often we don't have answers for that. But see, medical research has given us a good head start in understanding the relationship between the choices that we make in our lifestyles, in our diet, and how that influences how we think and how we act out. There was a study done, published in the European Journal of Psychology, and done by Dr. Pearl Martin at Queensland University, published in July of 2006. And what they had done is they had taken the amount of caffeine found in 2 cups of coffee and put it into orange juice. Pretty clever. And, of course, caffeine in itself has no taste. And so they developed a randomized trial where they'd give half the group regular orange juice and half the group spiked orange juice, spiked with 2 cups worth of caffeine. Not the coffee, just the caffeine. 3.5 milligrams per kilogram body weight. What they found was really interesting. They found that the caffeine actually dramatically increased the data processing capacity of that individual. And so they were able to take in a lot more information, and as the arguments were made, you see, they were trying to discover whether this had any influence on the decisions that people made about information that they were given. And they found that that as the arguments were made for or against certain conditions, they were actually talking about euthanasia in this study, they found that those who had been exposed to the orange juice with the caffeine were far more likely to accept that argument. Interesting. But, see, the problem is that while they had a dramatic increase in the processing capacity of the brain, they also had a dramatic decrease in the function of the frontal lobe, which is the part of the brain that brings morality and that brings critical thinking and judgment and will to bear. And so it's not about being smarter, because caffeine can make people smarter. It's actually a speed learning drug. I'll tell you a quick story. I learned this when I was in college, my freshman year. And it just so happened that I was going into my finals that first quarter of my freshman year with all B's. And I had aspirations of going on and going to graduate school and getting into healthcare. And so I wanted to get good grades. I didn't want to start out my first quarter in college without getting my grades up. And so during my classes, I had learned, it was a class on drugs, behavior, and society. I learned that caffeine was a speed learning drug. I'm very quick to apply all this information to my own life. I decided that I was going to go into my finals week, and for the first time in my life, I walked into a grocery store and walked out with a six-pack of Pepsi. I'd always been very health-oriented, health-conscious, and I had never done that before, but I was on a mission. I was doing research. I wanted to see the effects of the speed learning drug on my performance. And sure enough, I'd study until about 2 in the morning after having 2 or 3 of these Pepsis. And remember, I hadn't drank any caffeine most of my life. And I would memorize everything for that finals. I'd get up in the morning at 8 o'clock and go, and I'd blow away the test. I knew it all. That evening, I'd walk out of the grocery store with another six-pack. So it wasn't all just for me, by the way. It was a friend of mine and I were doing this together. And I'd study until 2 in the morning, and I'd go the next morning and just blow the test away. I did that 5 days in a row, got all my grades up to A's or A-minuses from B's. I was elated. There was a catch, though, is that for the next 2 weeks, I didn't feel like doing anything. I had lost my ambition. I had lost my resolve. I had lost my interest. I was tired. I was lethargic. And worse yet, I couldn't remember the first thing about what I had learned that previous week for final. You see, caffeine is a speed learning drug that's very effective short term. But that's all it's good for, short term. No long term there. So I made a pact with myself after that. I learned something. I'm glad I did that. I learned something from that experience, is that you can get a dramatic benefit right away, okay, but you'll be paying for it for the rest of your life. Because all that information that I could have retained and benefited me for life and for school and for my clinical work, gone. It was just gone. So what is the purpose of going to college? Is it getting your grades up? Or is it actually learning something that you can take into your profession and into your life? And so I learned something very important about the speed learning drug. Now, so this study showed that you could increase the suggestibility of people by giving them caffeine. Interesting. And it was dubbed liquid hypnotism. Interesting choice of words. See, what's the purpose of hypnotism? Hypnotizing is an attempt to essentially bypass the frontal lobe. so that people will accept what we say or what we're telling them to do without any critical thought or any judgment of morality or will. It's just, you just do it. You accept it. And so that is an important understanding that I gained with regards to caffeine. Now, how does this relate to mood? How does this relate to attitude? There is a growing phenomenon across the world that relates to what we call adrenal fatigue. How many of you have heard of that concept? Many of you. Adrenal fatigue had been considered to be a non-diagnosis for a long time. It's actually, adrenal insufficiency is a medical term that relates to Addison's disease. And you may recall that President John F. Kennedy actually had a form of Addison's disease. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he would be popping lots of pills. People thought they were painkillers. Most of those pills were actually adrenal extracts that he was taking to support his adrenal function because his adrenals were too weak to do that on their own. And so he did not have enough mental, emotional, or physical energy unless he had more of this adrenal support. So the question is, what are the things in life, what are the choices that we're making that influence our adrenal fatigue so powerfully? What are the things that are tearing down the adrenal function? You see, unless our adrenal glands are releasing the stress hormones, the cortisol and the adrenaline, on a steady state all day long, unless that's happening, we can't be healthy. If that isn't released continually, our immune system drops off. We know that if the cortisol levels drop too low because the adrenals are weak, that leads to low blood sugars. And what happens when our blood sugars get low? We become the type of person that nobody wants to be around. And some of us understand that better than other people. But I wish we had more time to get into that, but there is a huge problem with mood swings that occur because blood sugars are going up and down, but that blood sugar fluctuation is caused by a weak adrenal system. And so what are the things that are tearing down our adrenal system? Well, the initial solution that we as a society use to build up our adrenal defense, our cortisol levels, is caffeine. So we get used to getting up and having caffeine to stimulate our adrenals and to kind of get that, as Dolly Parton put it, that cup of ambition. Okay, get ambition back, get energy back, and feel like, all right, I'm ready to tackle the day. Okay, but that's the good side. If that's all caffeine did, we should all be taking it all day long. Okay, the problem is that that's just the first part of the effect of the caffeine. It's actually, where is it getting that energy from? It's stimulating adrenals to work harder than they should have to work. And so it's actually taking our vitality from tomorrow and using it today. Kind of sounds like our economy, doesn't it? Right? We are putting down a credit card to spend money that we don't have from our check that hasn't even arrived, and from an employment that hasn't actually occurred yet. And so we're spending money we don't have, and we're gradually getting indebted. We're stealing from our future, and that's what's happening to our physical health, which then impacts our emotional health. So what are some of the solutions as we're closing today? What are some of the solutions to address this challenge of mood and attitude? And first of all, it's an understanding that every physical, every natural remedy that we employ, whether it be exercise or nutrition or getting adequate sleep at night and paying attention to the circadian rhythms of our lives, paying attention to breakfast and lunch and dinner and eating regularly and making sure our digestion is working properly, because that, I can't tell you how many problems I see that are caused primarily because of digestive problems. People don't think they have a digestive problem, but that's what's driving their problems. And so all these different lifestyle factors, getting out into the bright sunlight every day, getting out even at noontime for a short period to get that vitamin D, all those factors come together and provide a powerful synergy. There was an interesting study a few years ago showing that just adding medium chain fatty acids, by the way, extra virgin coconut oil is 60% medium chain fatty acids. But just adding that to the diet of people who are starting to have cognitive dementia or are moving into the Alzheimer's range dramatically brought back, it reconnected the nerves in the brain. It gave fuel to the brain that it didn't have before. And it caused people who had severe symptoms of not being able to recognize and not being able to abstract and draw things the way they should appear. It reversed that in weeks, just getting the energy. So we need to find a way to get the right nutrients, the right healing agents into the body so that the body's natural healing system can take over the way it was designed to by God. So all these things are important. But I want to suggest to you, as we've been implying this evening, that the ultimate remedy, the most important of all the natural remedies, is learning to accept and then to give love to others. The most important quality of love is the quality of first being able to accept forgiveness, because it's readily available. It's readily available. If not, from our friends and family today, it's readily available by God, from God. It's available, and once we understand and accept that, we then can start giving it to others. We can shine that light like a mirror onto somebody else and give them something that can change their lives forever. I frequently think back about this story of this middle-aged lady. Actually, she wasn't middle-aged. She was in her early 60s. That is middle-aged, isn't it? Okay, that's middle-aged. Especially if we're paying attention to these principles, that's certainly middle age. She was willing to go beyond just addressing her cholesterol, beyond just addressing her blood sugars and her blood pressure and her weight and all the risk factors that we can look on the lab test. And she took it a step further and evaluated her emotional health and found that she was lacking considerably, that she was at risk every day. Her emotional disconnection with her neighbors was causing far more damage to her cardiovascular health, to her immune health, to her neurologic and brain health than any amount of cholesterol, any amount of other negative behavior that she could participate in. And when she recognized that intellectually, scientifically, and then took that uncomfortable step in dealing with the pain in her life at all costs, and initially sharing that discomfort with a friend, and then having that friend help bridge that gap. But that's what we need friends for. They bridge the gap to help us deal with our pain head on. And once it's dealt with, we wonder why we waited so long. So here's the challenge. It's been said that loneliness is malnutrition of the soul that comes from living on substitutes. Could it be that in our quest for health, we have been doing all kinds of good things, but indeed, in fact, they have been just substitutes for the most important natural remedies, and that is redefining love in our lives, the willingness to extend ourselves for the purpose of nurturing our own and someone else's spiritual and emotional wellness. Redefining forgiveness. Forgiveness is not something for people who come groveling to us and begging for our forgiveness. Forgiveness is for us. It heals us when we forgive even the unforgivable, when we forgive somebody before they ask, when we forgive somebody in spite of the fact that they're not at all interested in asking for forgiveness or recognizing what they have done. If we're willing, in spite of that, to forgive, we have just initiated the most powerful healing action that we could ever participate in. The most powerful healing action that is emotional, that is spiritual, that is physical. It's unlocking the bonds of hostility and inflammation in our body. It unlocks them. That's the only way we can get rid of hostility in our lives, is to embrace love and forgiveness. So loneliness is malnutrition of the soul that comes from living on substitutes. And it was Blaise Pascal, a French thinker, who said, "There is a God-shaped vacuum in the human heart that only God can fill." That's the initial source of love and forgiveness in our lives. Aristotle said, "We are what we repeatedly do." Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. So what I like to encourage you to do, or to think about today, is there something in your life that has bound illness within you, has incapacitated the ability of your body to heal naturally? Is there some unresolved issue in your life with a mother, a father, dead or alive, a son or a daughter, dead or alive, a neighbor, a coworker, a relative, that has impaired your ability for healing to take place naturally? And if there is, I'd like to suggest you don't wait for them to come to you. Okay? Just go to them. Don't worry about their response. Okay? Their response is up to them. Focus on your part. Focus on what you can do to restore that relationship, to provide forgiveness even where forgiveness is not deserved. And if you in the next 24 hours are willing to just, we're all thinking about something right now, I believe. We're all thinking about something. If you're in the next 24 hours are willing to just pick up the phone or to drive by somebody's house and say, "Hey, I just wanted to call and let you know that I feel bad about," don't worry about what you're going to say, okay? It's not the eloquence in our apology. It's not in the eloquence of how we're willing to forgive that melts hearts. What melts hearts and what restores relationship is the willingness to extend ourselves, the willingness for us to put ourselves in that discomfortable, that uncomfortable situation, and be willing to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, I just want to let you know that this is important to me. And I feel like an idiot, because it's been years since I should have called you a long time ago. But I just want you to know that I don't want this to be something that interferes with our relationship anymore." Whatever it might be for you, in the next 24 hours, I encourage you to do that. That would be the most powerful health-enhancing action we could participate in if we do that. Well, before we move on to the dinner with the doctor portion of this, why don't we just have a word of prayer as we begin that. Father, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to look at health, maybe from a different point of view that we have during our lives. There's so many things that we can participate in that influence our physical health. But I think we better understand now the power of love and forgiveness and how we can all have that in our own lives and how it can restore health to a far greater degree than we could ever imagine. So I pray, Lord, that you be with each one of us as we go on our little journey over the next 24 hours and seek to restore relationships, to seek to restore love and forgiveness into our lives. And we thank you for the community that we have here. We thank you for the healing that takes place as we commune together, as we enjoy each other's company, as we eat together and share knowledge about this creation that you have entrusted to us. So we thank you for those opportunities. In Jesus' name, amen.